2 weeks ago, we introduced the story of David and Bathsheba. It's a story of a guy who sees a woman and is attracted to her. And even though she is the wife of one of his friends, one of the soldiers that he has sent off to battle, he has her come into his house and he sleeps with her. The story of David and Bathsheba opens up some very uncomfortable issues that are important for us to talk about. And because they're important and because they're uncomfortable, we're going to pause and just pray for a moment before we get into this. So let's just pray and ask God to do his work this morning. Father, I thank you this morning that your word is honest. We see guys like David, and there is so much about his life that is heroic and that challenges us and that we want to follow his example in so many ways. And I thank you that you chose not to cover up the fact that he was also deeply flawed. And he fell into sin and he made some bad choices that affected him and many other people. I thank you that you included that story because it reminds us that there are warnings. It reminds us that we have weaknesses, that we struggle, and it reminds us that it's important for us to keep our guard up and to not allow ourselves to follow the bad examples. I pray as we look into your word today, Holy Spirit, that you would come and that you would teach us. And I pray that you would soften our hearts towards your truth, Lord. That as we talk about a difficult subject, that we would receive it in the way that you would have us to receive it. That we would allow you to speak to us and to challenge us. And I pray that the result of our time together would not be that anybody walks out of here feeling judged, that nobody walks out of here feeling hopeless or defeated, but that we walk out of here with a renewed awareness of the importance of standing strong in the face of temptation. And I pray for anybody here today who might be struggling with this issue, for anyone here today who has been deeply wounded because of somebody else's struggle with this issue, God, I pray that you would bring healing and restoration, that you would bring freedom and that you would bring forgiveness. And we thank you that because of what Jesus did for us on the cross, all of that is available to us. In Jesus' name, amen. All right, if you would take just a second and turn to the person next to you and say, buckle up because this is not going to be fun. Just go ahead and do that real quick. All right, so we talked about David and Bathsheba. And the main point that we made, and I would encourage you, if you weren't able to be here that week, to listen to the podcast because it sets up the foundation for what we're going to be talking about today. But the main issue that we talked about last time was the fact that David's sin did not just happen. His sin followed a fairly predictable pattern. It's a pattern that all of us go through whenever we give in to temptation. So let me just do a quick pop quiz and see, do any of you remember that four-step pattern that we talked about without looking at your notes if you're one of those people that takes notes? Does anybody remember what the four steps are? Okay, now I'm discouraged. Okay, just kidding. You weren't here, so. Okay, so here we go. The four steps were I saw, I desired, I took, and I hid. In fact, let's say them out loud together. I saw, I desired, I took, I hid. That is the pattern you and I follow every time we give in to temptation. Every time we disobey God, that's the pattern we follow. So the first step, I saw. This is where we come across something, a thought pops into our minds, we hear something, we see something, and we realize if I did that, that would be sin. If I acted on that impulse, if I acted on that desire, that would be wrong for me to do. And so as soon as we have that awareness, this would be sin, we have a choice. Either to walk away from that temptation or to continue to engage that temptation and go to the next step. The next step, I desired, this is where we think about it. This is where we give it room in our minds. We mull it over. We tell ourselves things like, it would be okay for me to do that. It's not that big of a thing. Yeah, it's wrong, but it's no biggie. It's not like I'm hurting someone. And we start to toy with the idea in our minds of, what would it look like if I did this? How could I do this and get away with it? And what happens is, as we give room to that temptation in our minds, the desire to follow through on that temptation grows and builds, and it becomes harder and harder for us to walk away and resist that temptation. So again, at that stage, we have a choice. We have a choice to either continue thinking about it, to go to the next step, or to say, you know what, this is wrong. I need to stop focusing on this and walk away and do something different. But then the next step is I took. This is where we do the thing we know we should not do. We do the action, we do the behavior, we focus our mind and we follow through on that temptation and we sin and we disobey God. And the next step that happens most of the time is I hid. This is where we try to cover it up because we feel guilty. We feel ashamed. We know we shouldn't have done that thing that we did. We know that it was wrong. And so we try to hide it. We try to cover it over. We try to convince ourselves it's okay. It's not a big problem. Or sometimes maybe we even go so far as to blame someone else so that we won't get caught, so that we won't get discovered. That's the four-step process that we go through every time we give in to temptation. And as we said last week, this first step is the place to stop it. If we want to be victorious over temptation, we can't go to the second step. The best place to win the battle is in that first step. When I see something, I become aware of something, and I know if I do this, it's sin. If I do this, it's wrong. That is the place to draw the line and say, I'm done, I'm turning away, and I'm walking away. I am not going to go any further with this. I'm not going to give it any room in my thoughts any longer. That is the best place to turn away, is that very first step. Because what happens is, the further we go in that process, the more complicated it becomes. The further we go in that process, the more people become involved in the process and are affected by our choices. And the further we go in that process, the more difficult it is for us to say no and to walk away. This is why Paul tells us in 1 Corinthians 6:18, he says, run from sexual sin. He says, when you are tempted sexually, when you're tempted to do something that you know is wrong, he says, don't think it over. Don't try to balance it out. Don't try to rationalize it. He says, run away from it. Don't see how close you can get to the line without crossing it. Run away. Why? Look what he says next. He says, no other sin so clearly affects the body as this one does. For sexual immorality is a sin against your own body. So Paul tells us here that sexual sin is in a different category from other sin. It has a deeper effect on us than other areas of sin do. And I think it's interesting that he gives a reason here. In other words, God gives us certain commands. He gives us certain guidelines, certain instructions. And Paul is saying God gives those instructions for a reason. There's a reason behind his instructions. And, you know, we live in a society where kind of the mantra is, well, as long as it's two consenting adults, that's fine. As long as it's two people that agree, it's totally fine. There's no problem with that. And that's the standard in our culture today, but that is not God's standard. And the important thing for us to know is that God knows better than our culture does. He's the one who invented sex, and he knows the impact that it has. He knows how amazing it can be between a husband and a wife, but he also knows the harm and the damage it can cause when it is misused. And so as we said 2 weeks ago when we first talked about this, God is not opposed to sex at all. He invented it. It was his idea to begin with, and he wants us to enjoy it. But because he wants us to enjoy it, and because he loves us, and because it was his idea, and he knows how it works and how it should not work, because of that, he gives us some very clear instructions on what's okay and what's not okay. And just to give you a simple example, this is a bottle of one of the cleaners that we use here at the church. So if you sign up for cleaning, you'll be using this. Now, this is a great product. Any of you use this in your home? Or something like this, maybe not necessarily Lysol, but so this is awesome because it says power. It's got power like 7 times on the bottle, right? So it says it powers through soap scum. It kills 99.9% of viruses and bacteria. So this is a great product, right? It kills the bad stuff, it cleans stuff, and it's a wonderful thing to have. But what's interesting is there's some warnings on here. And I'm not going to try to read them off of here because I'm almost 50 years old, and this is printed in like 1-point font. So I made a photocopy of it, and I blew it up to like 5,000%. So here's what some of the warnings say. It says, danger, corrosive. That's all in caps, and it's bold. I wouldn't have known that just by looking at it. If it's so dangerous, why don't they make it bigger than like that, right? But it says danger, corrosive, causes irreversible eye damage and skin burns. Wow. I mean, I read that, I'm like, I don't even want to touch the bottle, right? I don't want irreversible skin burns and eye damage. It says harmful if swallowed. Do not get on eyes or skin or clothing. Do not breathe vapor or fumes. Keep out of reach of children. And that's just a few of the warnings. There's like a whole section, and there's all the stuff of what to do if you violate one of these rules. Basically, the short version is get to the hospital right away. So, you know, as I'm reading this over, it's like there's a lot of rules here. There's a lot of don'ts. Like, it sounds kind of judgmental. They're saying, don't do this. This is bad if you do this. This is wrong if you do this. There's only one way and one way only to use this product. If you use it any other way, you're doing it the wrong way. That kind of sounds like they're trying to take away our fun. Like they're being too restrictive and too judgmental. But the truth is, the reason they give those instructions and those warnings is because they are the creators of the product. And they understand what can happen if that product is misused. And the same thing is true with God. He is the creator of our bodies. He is the creator of our sexuality. And so he knows, he understands what can happen if that is misused. And so he gives us some guidelines in his word. And if you take all of that and compress it down into one simple statement, that one simple statement would go something like this. Sex is a gift from God, and it is for a man and a woman in the context of marriage. Anything outside of that is a perversion of that gift, and it's a violation of his commands and his instructions. Now, that's not popular in this day and age. It's not popular to talk about that in this day and age because, again, the mantra is, hey, it's two consenting adults, so no problem. Nobody's getting hurt. Everything's fine. Again, that's not God's standard. And basically God says to us, this is a gift and I've created it for you. I want you to enjoy it. But make sure you follow the guidelines. Make sure you pay attention to the warnings because if you don't use it correctly, if you misuse it, if you abuse it, you're going to harm yourself and you're going to harm a lot of other people as well. And that becomes very clear as we get into the story of David and Bathsheba. So let's take a look again. In 2 Samuel chapter 11, just the first couple verses that give us the summary of the story. Here's what it says. Late one afternoon, after his midday rest, David got out of bed and was walking on the roof of the palace. As he looked out over the city, he noticed a woman of unusual beauty taking a bath. He sent someone to find out who she was, and he was told she is Bathsheba, the daughter of Eliam and the wife of Uriah the Hittite. And then David sent messengers to get her, and when she came to the palace, he slept with her. Now, the main takeaway from this story that we're building on 2 weeks ago and again today is that this didn't just happen. This last verse here was the culmination of a process. There was a progression of temptation and sin that led David to this point, and as we're going to see today, it ends up going much further than that as well. But it's that process of I saw, I desired, I took, and I hid. So again, 2 weeks ago, we talked about just this first step, I saw, where David is walking around and he sees her and he's attracted to her. Now, at that point, he has not sinned. At that point, he becomes aware of something that is tempting to him. He hasn't sinned yet. He has options at this point, right? And his options are to turn around, to walk away, go back into the palace, and do what God has called him to do, be the king of Israel. That's his best option. And as I said before, this is the place to stop the process. As soon as I become aware, this is a temptation, for me to do this would be sin, for me to do this would be wrong, this is the place to turn away, or as Paul says in 1 Corinthians 6, to run away. To just get away from that temptation as far and as fast as possible. But David didn't do that. At this first step, he said, yes, I'm going to go to the next step. And so he continues further in verse 3 again. He sent someone to find out who she was, and he was told she is Bathsheba, the daughter of Eliam and the wife of Uriah the Hittite. So now he's at that second step, desire. He's asking about her. Instead of turning away, instead of walking away from the temptation, he says to himself, let me find out some more information about this person. I've got some questions. I'm curious. And now he's toying with the temptation in his mind. He's opening himself up to engaging with that sinful desire. And it's because of this, it's because of this step, this is why Paul says, run from sexual sin. This is why Jesus in Matthew chapter 5 said, it's not just the act itself, it's the thought that leads to the act that is the problem. And so Jesus says in Matthew 5, you've heard it said, don't commit adultery. That's true, but I'm going to take it further than that. If you look at someone with lust, you've already committed adultery in your heart. Why did he say that? Because when we give attention to the thought, when we focus on that temptation, we begin to rationalize it, we give it credibility. The more thought we give to it, the more likely we are to follow through and commit the act that that temptation is leading us to do. And so while David is at that first step, I saw, he has an option. The option is to turn away. But he chose not to do that. He kept looking. And he asked the question, who is this? And the report comes back, this is the wife of Uriah. Now again, David is at the second step, but he has options, right? What are his options at this point? You can talk now, it's okay. To walk away, leave her alone, right? Like his option, his best option here is to say, okay, the wife of Uriah, so she is married to my friend. Oh, and by the way, I'm a married man too. So the answer obviously is no, this is over. I'm walking away right now. That's his best option. In fact, what makes this whole thing even worse is the betrayal that happens here. This is the wife of Uriah. Uriah is a friend of David's. But more than that, Uriah was one of his soldiers. And more than that, Uriah was one of David's personal bodyguards who was with him long before he even became king. We talked about the time when David was hiding out in caves because Saul was hunting him down and wanted to kill him. Uriah was one of the men who came and joined up with him and literally risked his life to protect David so that David could one day become king of Israel. And this is the man whose wife David is about to sleep with. So again, these steps, I saw he has a choice to turn away, but he didn't. He engaged with the temptation and he kept looking. The next step, I desire. He asks questions. His desire is growing. Again, he has a choice. Okay, she's married. She's married to my friend. I'm a married man. That's all I need to know. It's time to walk away, but he didn't. He didn't turn away when he should have, and he didn't walk away when he could have. And so it led inevitably to the next step. I took. And so we come to verse 4. And it says, David sent messengers to get her. And when she came to the palace, he slept with her. So he betrays a friend. He breaks God's commandments. And he sleeps with a woman who is not his wife. Looking led to desiring. And desiring led to acting. And at every step in this process, David had the opportunity to say no. At every step in this process, he had the opportunity to turn away, to walk away, to stop the process, and the story would have ended then and there. But at every single stage, he said yes, and he went further. And the point is, with this whole four-step process, the point is, this was not an accident. This was not a mistake. Oops, it just happened. Oh, I couldn't help myself. No, not at all. The devil didn't make him do it. David made a series of deliberate and intentional choices that led him to this place. And every choice he made took him further and further into sin and further away from God. And the same thing is true of us as well. When we are tempted, there is a point of decision. In fact, there are several points of decision where we can either choose to take the next step and pursue sin, or we can choose to run away and pursue righteousness. And as bad as this is, the story actually gets worse than that, because the fourth step is I hid. So this happens. And David thinks, nobody has to know. Two consenting adults just between the two of us. No harm, no foul. Uriah doesn't have to find out about this. Everything is fine. But then one day, he gets this news. Verse 5. Later, when Bathsheba discovered she was pregnant, she sent David a message saying, I'm pregnant. All of a sudden, what began as a moment of heated passion has become incredibly complicated. Because now his sin is going to become obvious. Now everybody is going to know what David has done. And so from this point forward, through the rest of this chapter, David's agenda is now, I need to do whatever it takes to hide this. I need to do whatever it takes to make sure nobody finds out what happened here. And so in the next several verses after this, David sends to the battle lines and he calls for Uriah to come back home. And he brings Uriah in and he says, hey, buddy, friend, you've been fighting hard. It's been a long battle. You're putting a lot into this. Why don't you take a couple days off? In fact, go home and just have a romantic evening with your wife. Just reward yourself. Because David is thinking if Uriah goes to Bathsheba, then when it's discovered Bathsheba's pregnant, everybody's going to figure, well, it's Uriah's son. That's because he came home from battle. That's right. I remember that. That's David's plan here. But Uriah, in this instance, is a much better man than David. Because his response to David is, are you kidding me? My men are out there fighting and bleeding and dying. How could I do that to them? How could I do something for myself? How could I do something that's so self-centered for a moment of pleasure when they're out there sacrificing everything? I would not do that. That would be disrespectful to them. And so he refuses. And David tries a few different tactics over the next day or so, and Uriah refuses. And so David sends him back to the battlefield, but he sends him with a note of instructions, and Uriah has no idea what's written on the instructions. So let's look at verse 14. So the next morning, David wrote a letter to Joab and gave it to Uriah to deliver. The letter instructed Joab, station Uriah on the front lines where the battle is fiercest, and then pull back so that he will be killed. So Joab assigned Uriah to a spot close to the city wall where he knew the enemy's strongest men were fighting. Do you see how this has escalated so quickly? From just a moment of desire into now lives are being taken. And David sends Uriah, his loyal friend, back to the battlefield, and Uriah is carrying with him, unbeknownst to him, his own death warrant. And so we come to the next verse. And when the enemy soldiers came out of the city to fight, Uriah the Hittite was killed, along with several other Israelite soldiers. As I said at the beginning, the further we go in that four-step process, the more people are affected by our decisions. This is a perfect example of that. See, not only is Uriah killed in this battle, many more families would mourn the death of a husband, a father, a son, a brother, who would no longer come home because of David's sin and his attempt to cover it up. You see, this whole idea of, I'm not hurting anyone, it just doesn't work. We may enter into a temptation thinking it's just between me and God, it's just this small thing, but so much of the time what happens is it takes on a life of its own and it grows bigger and bigger and it ends up affecting the lives of far more people. So I just want to point out three things from this story that I think are important warnings for us to be aware of in our own lives as we face temptation and as we make decisions about what to do with that temptation. The first one is this, that the small things usually lead to the bigger things. Here's what I mean by that. If you would, we've been talking about David for a few months now. If you would have asked David a question about this moment in his life a few years beforehand, or months beforehand, or even a couple of days before, if you would have asked David, David, could you imagine a day when you would sleep with the wife of one of your soldiers while he's at battle? Can you imagine a day when you would do that and then you would have that same man killed? Can you imagine a day when you would do that? Can you see yourself doing that? I'm sure David would have said, no, that's ridiculous. I would never do something as horrible as that. No, forget it. That's not going to happen. And yet David moves very quickly from being a loyal friend to being an adulterer and a murderer. How did that happen? Well, it didn't just happen overnight. It began small. It began with just one step and then taking the next step in the wrong direction. It began with one look and then another look. It began with one thought and then another thought. It began with one rationalization and then another rationalization. See, again, the further we go in that process, if we're able to excuse this, then the further we go, we can excuse bigger and more horrible things that we never would have dreamed of excusing before. But the further we go, the easier it becomes to excuse the things we have engaged in. And so the same thing is true with us. What starts small, what we rationalize as no big deal, it takes on a life of its own and it becomes much bigger and it affects the lives of many other people. The other thing I want to point out is that sin is not just between me and God. It's not just something it's just a personal thing. It's just a me and God thing. No, because it affects other people. Our decisions affect those around us, those closest to us, and sometimes it becomes more widespread than that. How many times we hear the lie, well, it's okay as long as you don't hurt anyone. I wonder if David thought that. You know, it's just the two of us. Nobody has to know. We're not hurting anyone. We're just having fun. It's no big thing. And it ends up hurting several people. And so Joab sends a report back to David because he knows David wants to hear back what is happening on the battlefield. And the report comes back to David in this way. It says, the enemy came out against us in the open fields. And as we chased them back to the city gate, the archers on the wall shot arrows at us. Some of the king's men were killed, including Uriah the Hittite. So David's sin affected a lot of other people. Lives are lost as a result of that. But I also want you to see that his sin damaged him as an individual. His sin harmed him as a person. Take a look at his response. He receives this report. Several of your soldiers have died in battle. Your friend Uriah, he's the only one mentioned by name. He has died in battle. Look at David's response. Tell Joab not to be discouraged, David said. The sword devours this one today and that one tomorrow. Fight harder next time and conquer the city. You see how calloused he has become? You talk about a hardened heart. A heart that is closed off to what matters to God. David finds out that his friend, Uriah, who has been loyal to him for decades now, is killed in battle because of his choices, because of his decisions. And this is David who mourned the death of his friend, Jonathan, years before. This is David who, when Saul, the king who tried to kill David, when Saul was killed in battle, David wrote a song mourning his death and led the entire nation in a time of mourning. And now he hears that his friend, his loyal friend, has been killed in battle because of his decisions. And his response is, oh well, people die. Try harder next time and let's finish this thing up. You see, when we continue to excuse sin in our lives, what happens is our hearts become hardened to the things that matter to God. And things that used to break our hearts, things that used to really be valuable and important to us, all of a sudden they take a back seat because we're more in pursuit of trying to hide what we've done. And we're not worried about what harm it brings to others in the process. That's where David is at this point. The last thing I want to say about this is that sin, no matter what we do to try to hide it, it's never truly done in secret. And take a look at the next couple of verses after verse 25. It says, when Uriah's wife heard that her husband was dead, she mourned for him. And when the period of mourning was over, David sent for her and brought her to the palace, and she became one of his wives. And then she gave birth to a son. So David brings her into the palace. They get married. Some time passes. and she gives birth to a son. And David is hoping that, okay, I had Uriah killed so that I could marry her. People hopefully won't pay too close attention to the timeline here, and they'll assume, okay, David and Bathsheba are married, so of course she's pregnant now, and this is his son, and David is hoping that he has covered his sin. He sits back and breathes a sigh of relief. But the story is not over yet, because the most important sentence in this entire chapter happens at the end of verse 27. Here's what it says. But the Lord was displeased with what David had done. That matters. That needs to matter to us. We talk about forgiveness a lot, and that's important. But there also comes a time when we need to realize that our choices, they affect the heart of God. You and I can do things that grieve him, that bring sorrow to his heart. And yes, there is grace, and yes, there is forgiveness. But I think many times we pass so quickly from my sins have consequences and they have an impact on someone else. Sometimes we pass over that so quickly and jump into, well, it's okay, God's going to forgive me, and he does. But this had an effect on David's relationship with God. God was saddened. He was displeased with what David did. And David thought he had it covered up, but he will very soon find out God was fully aware of everything he did. And David's sin would carry some devastating consequences that would follow him pretty much for the rest of his life. Years from now, several of David's sons, his own sons, would rebel against him and try to overthrow his kingdom. And as a result of that, several of those sons, his own sons, would die very tragic and violent deaths. David would be publicly embarrassed and humiliated in front of the entire nation of Israel, and more innocent people would die. The last few years of David's life, his reign, which should have been an amazing time for him and the nation of Israel, he started with such promise, but the last few years of his life were marred by tragedy and conflict, and all of it is traced back to this moment in his life. Now, this is not a happy message to give or to hear. And as I said 2 weeks ago, I've not been looking forward to this part of David's life because it's very uncomfortable. It's a downer. And usually my part of my goal is I want you to walk out of here with renewed hope and encouragement. And here's a plan of action. Here's some things to do this week. Here's how God's going to work in your life. But today, the story doesn't really give itself to that yet. We'll get to that next time. But for right now, I think it's important for us just to absorb the seriousness of sin and the fact that our choices, they have consequences for us, and many times they have consequences for other people. In Matthew chapter 5, Jesus said something that is kind of shocking. He said, if your hand causes you to sin, cut it off. If your eye causes you to sin, gouge it out. Now, as I look around the room, I'm assuming none of us have taken those instructions literally. And that's a good thing. I don't think that's what Jesus intended us to do. I think there are two things that he is saying to us in that odd and somewhat sickening instruction. The first one is this. I think Jesus is saying to us that we should be repulsed by sin. That sin should repulse us just as much as the idea of cutting off our own hand or gouging out an eyeball. That the idea of ending up where David ended up, the idea of going so far away from God, the idea of so turning our back on his calling and his purposes for us, the idea of making choices that have such a devastating impact on so many other people, the idea of becoming so deaf to the voice of the Spirit and having our consciences so dulled to where we aren't even willing to recognize this is the wrong thing to do, that very idea should absolutely sicken us. And I think the other thing he's saying is we should be willing to take drastic measures to avoid going to the next step and the next step and the next step in that process. that whatever it is that is leading us into temptation, whatever it is that opens that door up for us to follow that path into sin, whatever that is in our lives, we should cut it off from ourselves. We should separate ourselves as quickly and as far as possible so that we don't end up one small step at a time where David ended up. So God, I pray that you will help us to stand strong in the face of temptation. Help us to live holy and pure lives. Thank you for the gift of sex. We choose to respect that gift. We choose to respect others. We choose to honor you with how we use our bodies. God, I pray that you will help us to be repulsed by the idea of falling away from you. And I pray that you will help us when we find that we have followed that path, when we find that we have given ourselves into temptation, that we have done something that has been displeasing to you. God, help us not to try to hide it like David did, but to come to you openly and honestly and to confess it to you and to believe in your grace, to believe in your redemption, to believe that you are the God who restores. And I pray especially this morning for anyone who is struggling with sexual temptation and sexual sin, I pray that this would be a day of freedom. I pray for anyone here today whose life has been harmed by the choices of somebody else, God, that you would bring healing and hope and restoration to their hearts. You are the God who brings back that which has been taken from us by the choices of others. I pray for that work to be done for those who need that. In Jesus' name, amen.